I Eat Green with Bhavani, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green, and I'm here with you for the next hour. I have a wonderful guest in the studio with me today. I'm John from Food Not Bombs, John Stefanon, and he is the co-founder of Long Island Food Not Bombs, which is a wonderful organization that I look forward to telling you more about. And I have a recipe to share with you, as always. But first, as always, I want to tell you about what's going on. First, let's start with the garden. It's been beautiful. We've recovered from Hurricane Irene just fine. Our tomatoes are winding down, but we have our greens that are really coming in strong. And I have my spring onions, which are still in the ground, looking great. I have my carrots that I've been eating still in the ground. I have burdock root that I am leaving there until I'm ready to make my winter stews. And thank God I still have a little time before that. But I'm also trying to clear out the beds that are finished and put some new seeds in for my late fall crops and early spring crops. I found originally by accident that when I planted my kale and my collards and my Swiss chard that I would have greens when the snow melted. So it was a surprise to me a few years ago when that first happened. You know, I thought I got my seeds in too late and I didn't really have much of a fall harvest. But when spring came and the snow melted, you know, I looked over and there in my garden were all these greens. So I started eating from the garden in March. So for those of you that are growing things, know that you can still, you know, get out there and plant again this fall so that you will have some vegetables in the spring. So there's a lot of events going on this fall, starting with this weekend. Slow Food USA is having a national challenge, and they call the challenge the $5 challenge. Taking back the value meal. And we are constantly hearing from people that organic food and healthy food shouldn't cost more, but it does, and that that's why they eat food that is not so good, because it's cheap and easily available. So our challenge is to create for you a delicious value meal that doesn't cost more than $5 a person. So we are actually opening up our home this weekend on September 18th, Sunday, from 6 o'clock on for this event. And you don't have to make anything. You just come, pay $5, register online at Slow Food USA. You can go to events. And we would love to have you here. There will be members cooking with me in the kitchen during the day, and we will put out modest but delicious feast for you. You're welcome to bring some wine along because that's not included. And we look forward to having you. And so that's this coming Sunday, September 18th at 6 o'clock at my home in Old Westbury. And you can register online and you'll get directions there. Okay? Also, very exciting, this Wednesday, Just Food is celebrating locally grown food with their annual fundraiser. It's called Just Food, Let Us Eat Local. And it's this Wednesday at 6 p.m. If you have a VIP ticket, or 7 p.m. for regular entrance. And it is an amazing event. It is bringing together all of the local restaurants in New York City. There's ABC Kitchen, Angelica's Kitchen, BLT Bar and Grill, Blue Hills, Candle 79, Jerk Candy, great restaurant, Eska, the Fat Radish, all the restaurants are great. Great performances will be there. Jimmy, number 43, Pure Food and Wine, Rosewater, the Spotted Pig, Telepan, Whitney Museum of American Art. There will be more than 40 restaurants there serving up a feast. And Joel Salatin, who was our keynote speaker this past March at the, actually it was April, this past April at the Long Island Small Farm Summit, he will be the guest honoree there as well. So come on down. It's at the Altman Building. You can register online at Just Food website. So it's justfood.org. And I hope to see you there. And then the next day, on Thursday, is another really great event. This is a free event, September 22nd from 7 to 9. Come down and see Frances Moore Lappe, Vandana Shiva, and Anna Lappe, Frances Moore's daughter, at the Cooper Union Great Hall. And they're putting together, you know, a great presentation for everyone that can come. Registration's free, but you should pre-register because it will close out. To register for that, it's smallplanetfund.org. Smallplanetfund.org. And Vandana Shiva is, you know, on the executive board of Slow Food International. She's an incredible speaker. I heard her speak at the Slow Food event in Torino, Italy, this past October. And she's just so moving to see speak. And Frances Moore Lappe is the first person that turned me on to this whole food movement. I was 16 when I read her book, Diet for a Small Planet, and that literally changed my life. And so, you know, I can say I owe the path that I'm on to that book. So hope you can come to that. And then next weekend, Slow Food Huntington, along with Long Island NOFA New York, and Food and Water Watch, we're all working together to bring another event to all of you. It is celebrating, again, locally grown food as part of NOFA New York's Locavore Challenge. And we will be getting together at Grossman's Farm. Actually, it's called now called Crossroads Farm at Grossman's, and that's in Malvern, New York. And that's going to be a great event as well, $5 for members, $10 for non-members. And Eric Weltzman, who was a guest on my show before, he will be there speaking about Food Day and the Food Bill. As you know, the Farm Bill is up for reauthorization. We've been calling it the Food Bill, but it's really the Farm and Food Bill. And it is the piece of legislation that decides so much about the food that we have access to. It decides how much money is allocated to food stamps and food banks. It decides how much money is allocated to subsidizing the farmers for industrial agriculture, and not enough goes to small farmers. And so we need to all become active and educated about this very, very important piece of legislation, do what we can to motivate our Congress people to vote the right way. And as you know, there's so much money out there to lobby for the other side that we really need everybody to get involved. So if you can come to that event in Malvern on Sunday, September 25th from 4 to 7, we'd love to see you there. So I could go on and on, but the easiest thing is actually to send me an email, bhavani@ieatgreen.com, and ask to be on my email list, and I will send you a list of all these great events, both local and not so local. So if you are from another area, since this is a national, actually international radio show, please send me an email and let me know about your event, and I'd be happy to spread the word. Tonight, actually, starting at 7 p.m., I do want to tell you about this. I happened to see Al Gore last night on the Gobert Report, and he was talking about tonight on the internet, 24 hours of reality, starting with, it's called the Climate Reality Project. So Google Climate Reality Project. It starts tonight at 7 p.m. for the next 24 hours, and there will be people on there from all over the world talking about climate change. So it should be a really interesting and informative 24 hours. So I'm certain that when I get back home tonight after this show, I will check it out as well. So I want to share my recipe with you so I can invite John on the show. This recipe is seitan with walnut sauce. And seitan, for those that don't know, is wheat meat. It's the gluten of the wheat, which is very high in protein. Not good if you have celiac, obviously. But for those, for others who are vegetarian, it's very high in protein, very low in fat, delicious, and it's very hearty. So walnut sauce is, you know, walnuts are used in many cultures much more frequently than in our food here in the States, as well as pomegranates. And they're both brain foods, the very high antioxidants and nutrients that are very good for us, and we need to incorporate more nuts and seeds and fruits like pomegranates into our diet. So this recipe is really wonderful. I start with 2 pounds of seitan, and I cut them into slices. Now, one thing I do, because so often I'm cooking for non-meat eaters, and it's just people, you know, like when it's crunchy, I very often will bread the seitan. But you don't have to do that. Obviously, it's already wheat. So, but if you want to make it crunchier, what I do is I bread it, you know, I either dip it in egg and breadcrumbs, or you can dip it in rice, milk, and breadcrumbs, just to, you know, have the breadcrumbs stick onto the seitan and then fry it up both sides the way you would any type of cutlet, and get it crunchy and then lay it out on some paper towel. If you do not want to fry it, that's fine too. You can just take the seitan and saute it in a little bit of olive oil till it gets a little crispy or golden on each side, and it's delicious like that as well. And then to make the sauce, you're going to start with a cup of onions, chopped onions, that you're going to saute with 4 cloves of chopped garlic in a pan with some olive oil. And you're going to sprinkle that with a teaspoon of cumin and continue cooking until the onions are translucent. And when you cook cumin, it really brings the flavor out. So you want to cook it with the cumin. Then you're going to add 1 to 2 tablespoons of tamari, depending on your preference for saltiness. And you're going to cook that at a high heat for 30 seconds. And then you turn it off and set it aside. Now, in a food processor, you're going to puree 1 cup of walnuts and 2 cloves of garlic with 1 cup of water. And you're going to puree that until you have a smooth paste, and then you're going to add 1 cup of pomegranate juice, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, organic tomato paste, and some minced red pepper. I use a teaspoon of minced red pepper just to make it a little spicy. If you don't like spice, you just leave that out. And as I always say, when you are the chef, you know, these are guidelines. My recipes are guidelines, and you can adjust it for your taste and your family's taste. So once you've minced the red pepper, then you add the onions. And you don't want to puree the onions because I like the onions. Well, you can puree the onions if you'd like to, but I like the onions to be visible. And I mix the sauce up, and then I just pour it right over the seitan, and that's it. You can garnish with chopped parsley or cilantro. Again, that's one of those preference herbs, depending on what you like. And that is it. It comes together really fast. You can, you know, if the seitan's hot, you can put the sauce right over it at room temperature, or you can heat the sauce up as well if you'd like. Either way, it's really is a treat. So this recipe will be posted on the Progressive Radio Network website starting tomorrow, so you can get it and download it. From there, Also, if you have any questions during my interview with John, you can call in. The call-in number is 888-874-4888. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to you John Stefanon. I know I'm saying your last name wrong. How do you say it? Hi, John.
It's pronounced Stefanon, but don't worry, no one can ever pronounce it.
Okay. Anyway, John is co-founder of Long Island Food Not Bombs, which is the largest Food Not Bombs chapter in the country. And Food Not Bombs is a complete volunteer organization and movement that coordinates the sharing of free groceries with thousands of people each week. John works to organize hundreds of volunteers confronting social issues that include poverty, homelessness, racism, sexism, and immigrant rights. So it's my pleasure, John, to have you on the air with me. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing good today.
Great. And I know this morning you had lots of pickups. What did you pick up this morning?
We got lots of fresh produce from Whole Foods. We got farm fresh produce from Dahlia Farms out in Huntington. And actually a lot of heavy cream today that we'll be distributing to different food pantries, probably in Nassau County.
Uh-huh. So things like the heavy cream you'll give to a pantry as opposed to bringing out onto the street?
We distribute it as well. It's just that with this hour, it's easier for us to bring it to someplace that might be able to refrigerate it.
Right.
We don't have any distribution later on this afternoon, so we'd rather see it, you know, used by someone maybe tonight, and there's a lot of pantries that could probably use it, or even like soup kitchens we sometimes supply food
right.
to.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit more about Food Not Bombs. I could have gone into it, but I wanted you to tell us in your own words what Food Not Bombs is and what it's been for you.
Sure thing. Food Not Bombs is an international movement that started about 30 years ago. It actually started in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it started as a protest to nuclear weapons. People were very upset about the amount of money the U.S. government was spending developing nuclear weapons, and thought if some, even just a small portion of that money was used to, say, feed the poor or provide better education for folks, you'd have a greater social benefit. You could actually prevent war by preventing poverty. If people are struggling less, there's less need for things like crime or terrorism. A lot of times people that fall into those tracks come from areas that are very impoverished. And so the basic idea about Food Not Bombs was spend your money on food and not bombs. So as a protest, eight people got together and started giving out free food on the street.
When was that?
That was in 1980. I believe it was May in 1980. And the original founders of Food Not Bombs ranged from people like Howard Zinn, who is a founder of Food Not Bombs, to Keith McHenry, who is still a very vocal advocate with issues of poverty and hunger. And he travels all around the world spreading this message that, you know, you can prevent violence with food. And since then, the idea of Food Not Bombs kind of caught on like wildfire. And so it spread across the country first. There was a very large chapter in San Francisco that grew in attention, and people kind of liked the idea. And so now there's Food Not Bombs chapters actually all across the world. There's over 1,000 chapters. There's chapters on every single continent, including Antarctica. There's scientists that do it out there as kind of like a statement. But it's different in every single location that you can find it because it's so community-oriented. And
right.
so the only tie between all the Food Not Bombs chapters in the entire world is basically the principle that we believe food is a right and not a privilege, and we think that basically governments should spend less money on weapons of destruction and more money on social programs that can benefit, you know, local communities, local populations that are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And Long Island Food Not Bombs came about 5.5 years ago. I started it with a friend of mine after college. We'd graduated together, and we couldn't find work, to be completely honest. We were sending out our resumes nonstop the entire summer, and we kind of got sick of not doing anything because it was just a tough job market. And we said, you know, we could start a volunteer project where people can give back to the community and I'd known about Food Not Bombs across the country. I've seen in other areas, and I said, this would be a great thing to start up. And we started our first location in Hempstead, I believe the spring of 2006. And back then we had one table and literally one garbage bag full of bread we would rescue from Trader Joe's. And since then, we have multiple locations all across Nassau County, Suffolk County, even Brooklyn. We supply food to different soup kitchens and food pantries. We're sharing food with 3,000 people a week. And when I say sharing food with them, I don't just mean a hot meal. We give everybody that's coming to us a week's worth of groceries. And so they're getting the produce they need. They're getting fresh bread. They're getting frozen foods and sweet items and grocery items. We're really just trying to alleviate that struggling that is occurring right now with many Long Island families and many individuals who are on tough times of just not having to worry about their groceries, at least. And that's kind of the basic, the day-to-day operation of what we do.
That's amazing. So all the chapters are not primarily vegan, as I know your chapter is, right?
All hot food that we distribute is vegan, and all groceries that Food Not Bombs distributes are vegetarian. And the idea behind that is vegetarian foods are less damaging to the environment. They also involve less waste. The production of beef through, fat mass factory farming is extremely wasteful. And, you might get 1 pound of beef, but the way that it's being produced, requires 100 pounds of grain and then, like 10 gallons of gasoline to ship it over to somebody.
And the amount of water, too. Let's not forget
the water. And a ton of water and pollution, and these things lead to such devastation. We don't hold back with our political beliefs because we feel like there's a lot of reasons why people are poor these days. And environmental destruction and war are huge parts of that. And so in areas where you have these massive agricultural complexes, you're destroying, local economies through pollution. You're destroying local farmers who used to make a living, growing their own crops, but now maybe this giant agribusiness has moved in and made it more difficult for the local farmer to sell his crop.
And is this a philosophy of Food Not Bombs, or is this the philosophy of Long Island Food Not Bombs?
Because
I know you said it represents each community, and I would think there's some communities that are not so agriculturally connected as Long Island.
No, this is an idea that's shared across all the different chapters, and it's one of the tenets, I would say, of all the Food Not Bombs chapters. There are Food Not Bombs chapters in the middle of huge urban areas that might be disconnected from local farms, but they still uphold these principles, and a lot of times those chapters will rely on CSAs, community-supported agriculture. In the third world, even where Food Not Bombs exist, there's a lot of countries where you'll actually have local farmers donate their food because they just think it's the right thing to do, even though maybe it's hurting them. It's a bad business idea to give away your product for free, but they want to support their community. Mm-hmm. And so, you'll have local farmers agree to give away half of what they're growing to the community to support the community. And in areas like Nigeria, where Food Not Bombs operates, the people that come to get food and are getting food to eat also volunteer at local farms. And they're helping out the local farmer. The Food Not Bombs chapters out there actually help raise money to collect seeds for the local farmer. And so a portion of the produce that the local farmer is growing is going back to the community that's benefiting from that. But another portion is being sold in the market so the farmer can make a living as well. And another principle of Food Not Bombs is trying to create a system of interdependence in a community. And you might have environmental boundaries that you live in a concrete jungle. We try to be very creative about ways we can find food for those people.
Mm-hmm. So most of your food is collected and reused. So it's, it's food that would otherwise... package is opened or, it's past the expiration date, but it's still good, kind of thing, right?
Most of the food we get out here in Long Island is food that would have been tossed in the trash. And mm-hmm. It's kind of absurd how much food we get. In the average week, we're distributing anywhere between 25 and 35,000 pounds of food. And all of that food that we collect, brand new bananas that are green, you know, cans that are perfectly good, but the label on them has changed because it's not as flashy as it used to be, so they're getting rid of it, even though the sell-by date's another 3 years away.
Right.
Yeah, we get all those products. And the sad truth is we work with an awesome collection of food stores that help us collect that waste, but even the best food stores are only giving us 5 to 10% of what is actually getting tossed out that's still usable.
Right. I know. I've talked to people in the store that, you know, it's like you do well when you have an advocate from the inside, because I know, you know, there's, you know, I go to my local Whole Foods and I know some of the people that are working there, and I know for many of the people, they just don't want to be bothered. You know, a lot of the workers, they just, you know, it's easier to just toss it. And you know, having an advocate on the inside that says, no, you know, people are coming later, let's save it, is really important.
And a lot of times people don't understand, too, the system of waste that exists in the country. One thing that we always talk about is there's this myth of food scarcity. There's a myth that there's not enough food to feed the world. Well, there is enough food to feed the world. It's just getting tossed out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
I think the statistic in this country, I think, if I'm not correct, I think it's like 70% of all the food.
Likely more than that, because all the agencies that try to examine food waste, they never look at the full spectrum. And so the USDA will look at it in terms of the farm producing the food and then shipping it off to a distribution center, but only that segment of it. And from the distribution center, maybe it's getting, you know, maybe there's 30% waste between the distribution center and the food store. And at the food store, there's 30% waste. And it goes on and on. And even at the U.S. home, most homes are wasting about 20 to 25% of the food that you go out and you go food shopping, you buy it, it sits in the fridge and it rots. And
right. There's
a huge amount of waste in our system. And we exist, and we could only exist because of that system of waste. And, you know, the reality is we're culling a little tiny portion of it. And there's a lot more out there that could be rescued, could be salvaged, and could be used by people. And, you know, if people think it might be somewhat spoiled food, it's a complete myth. We deal with food stores that are just simply lacking storage space. And so a tractor trailer truck would come with brand new bananas, green bananas that probably won't even ripen for another week. And they'll look at it and say, well, this truck's come with the bananas, but we already have bananas out, and it'll cost us too much money in terms of labor to unload the bananas and restock the new bananas and get rid of the old bananas, so we'll just toss out these brand new bananas.
Right.
And that is the norm in our society. And so a lot of stuff we get is fresher than the stuff you'd buy in the food store. And I can tell you that because I work in the back of these food stores every single day. And it's just, it's because of the business dynamic that exists right now. And it's encouraging waste.
Right. The other thing, you know, I like to remind people of is there's really no such thing as throwing it away. It has to go somewhere. You know,
Exactly. Kids,
you know, I've worked in schools, and everyone just thinks, oh, just throw it away. And they don't think, what happens when you throw it away? Where does it go? So that's a question I have for you, actually, is do you have access to the stuff that is rotten? I'm sure, you know, you have some stuff that you collect that is not good enough for your, you know, partners. Where do you have access to donate it to a compost so that it's not going to the garbage?
Every bit of organic waste that we can't use, we compost, and we use for community gardening efforts. We have a lot of local farmers we give compost to. A lot of our volunteers have compost piles, and they'll offer to take some stuff for the night.
Mm-hmm.
All cardboard waste, we recycle. Plastic waste, we try to reuse. And so literally, we try to limit as little waste as humanly possible.
Right, so
and
your footprint's very small.
Yeah.
I love that.
We'll have less than 5 pounds of maybe plastic or rubber or metal waste left over at the end of the day from 10,000 pounds of materials we got. That's why we're very passionate about it. That's why we're trying to salvage the food, because we don't want to see it go to waste, and we don't want to see stuff that could become food next year in a compost pile go to waste either.
Right. Well, I saw Will Allen speak a few weeks back, and you know, he was talking about everything. It's all about the soil, and he was talking about the composting that he has going on in Milwaukee. It's just mind-boggling, and I'm thinking, we could do that here. You know, there's so much waste, and there's so much land that could just, you know, become a compost pile. It's just amazing.
And it's better than a landfill, you know. You can have something be tossed out in a compost pile and it'll biodegrade in a week, whereas an apple tossed out in a landfill might take like a year or two to biodegrade because there's so much
garbage and
chemicals
and,
yeah, mm-hmm. other things there.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to be as environmentally sustainable as possible. Admittedly, a lot of what we do revolves around driving. So there is that issue, but we try to find even creative ways around that. We try to carpool. We try to use, you know, as little vehicles as we have to. But we still do have to, you know, ship the food back and forth.
Now, when you are preparing hot meals, how do you do that? Where does that get cooked? And then how do you serve that to the people? Because I know, you know, I have been feeding the homeless for years myself, and I hate to admit it, but I've been using these styrofoam fold top trays that, you know, I give to people so that they can, so that we can serve it and they close them. And I know now they're coming out with, you know, biodegradable, you know, green cardboard items. But I, you know, I'm looking for a place to actually get them at a reasonable price because they are, you know, like four times the amount of money as the styrofoam ones. So, how do you serve to your clients? Do they know to bring containers, and or how do you do it?
People that come to us for food, it depends on the location, but I can give you a few examples. In Hempstead, you know, volunteers prepare food at their homes, and everything that we're cooking has to be vegan. And all that food is then brought to the food share, and we kind of do it like a potluck or like a barbecue. Everyone's invited to participate in the cooking. And in terms of distributing the food, we're lucky enough that we get a lot of donations of biodegradable, like knives and forks. We've kind of worked ourselves very closely with some catering businesses that use them. So we have lots of crates of biodegradable forks, biodegradable knives, spoons. We have paper plates that we can actually compost, and I compost them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people are done with their food, we have a special garbage can that people can toss out those items into. The only thing that we have right now that's not biodegradable are plastic cups. It's very difficult to find biodegradable cups, and we use the cups for usually hot tea and for soup, and you know, paper cups don't really work very well for hot soup sometimes, at least in our experience, and so that's probably the one thing that we use that's probably the least biodegradable. But a lot of, you know, what we do, we just try to focus on and where do these things get sold. Like if it's a biodegradable plates, where do they get sold? And the likelihood is that they're probably tossing them in the trash, too. And so we can try to work a deal out with them that when they cut open a crate and they accidentally break the box of 6,000 spoons in it, give us the spoons, and we'll give you a tax write-off. And so that's kind of how we're lucky enough to get these things.
Wow. I have so many questions, but I'm looking at the time. We actually need to take a break. Let's take a few-minute break, and when we come back, I want to ask you about this other nonprofit that you started, the Community Solidarity Incorporated.
Sure.
Okay? So we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere, everyone. And I'm talking with John from Food Not Bombs. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and I'm here with John Stefanian from Long Island Food Not Bombs. It's a really great nonprofit organization that brings food recovery to people in need. And we've been talking about the philosophy of Food Not Bombs, and John, are you there?
Yep.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Sure. So when we took a break before, I just was bringing up the issue about the other nonprofit that you started, Community Solidarity Incorporated. What is that, and why did you feel the need to start another nonprofit as well?
Well, actually, Food Not Bombs is not a nonprofit organization. Food Not Bombs is a community organization. And the reason for that is we, at Food Not Bombs, everybody has an equal voice, and everyone is encouraged to participate in some form or another. Nonprofit organizations, by law, have to have a board of directors, a group that is responsible for finances, and people that have a small degree of hierarchy over each other. With Food Not Bombs, we always wanted to make sure that everybody could feel like they owned the group. That it was their community coming together, and that it wasn't one group of people trying to help out another group, but it was just, this was the neighborhood. And
so how,
the neighborhood,
how does that work with differently if somebody wanted to make a donation, or like you said, you can give someone a tax write-off if they make a donation? How does that work?
Well, Food Not Bombs itself doesn't take any money. It doesn't take a $1,000 donation from anybody, and we don't spend any money. Our nonprofit that we created, Community Solidarity, is able to do that. And that was actually one of the reasons why we created the nonprofit that we currently have. Basically, the principle and how we operate Food Not Bombs requires no money. We're all volunteers. Basically, we kind of cough up the cash sometimes if we need to buy certain items, like a folding table or something like that. We'll all chip in a dollar, and we'll get a folding table. And there was never really any need for it. What ended up happening about a few years ago was we realized we were so large, and we were spread across all of Long Island, and people kept offering us things that we couldn't actually accept. People would offer us donations of land or money or a vehicle donation. And we said, you know what, those are items that we could probably use, but we can't accept them as a community organization. And we decided to create a separate organization called Community Solidarity. We didn't want to make Food Not Bombs into a nonprofit because we liked the idea of everyone having ownership over it, of it kind of being a community that, you know, I might be a very vocal member of it, but my opinion matters no more or greater than anyone else's opinion, even the person that shows up for the first day and just wants a hot plate of food. And we wanted to keep that spirit alive with what we do, so we created Community Solidarity Incorporated. And Community Solidarity is just kind of a natural evolution to what we're doing out here because we believe in the idea of solidarity and not charity. We want to make sure that everybody in the community is participating in some form or another. The last thing we want to do is give out a handout. If someone's struggling, we want to help them get on their feet, but we want them to participate in some form or another in their community as well. And so there was a lot of things that we learned doing Food Not Bombs, really great skills and useful tactics that we realized other nonprofits weren't employing. And so we took those tactics and we put it into Community Solidarity. And so our hope with Community Solidarity is to aid other nonprofit organizations and aid local activists in achieving their goals with kind of a more grassroots direct action backing. So we invite ourselves, we invite anyone to come to us. People have come to us and said, I want to make a mural project. How do I start a mural project? And we try to take the resources with our nonprofit and kind of fuel their idea. Say, you know, get your friends together. If you need help with money, getting paint or something, maybe we can get paint donations, or maybe we'll buy paint for you. Let's talk to some businesses. Maybe they would like a mural on their wall. And we do the same with community gardening. Someone says, I would really love a garden in my neighborhood. We'll start looking around and helping them where we can as a broader organization, because we have all these tools and resources now at our disposal, and we want to help other folks with their creative ideas that could benefit the community. And so Food Not Bombs, in the name, like, we focus on food and we also give out clothing, but we realized what we do can be translated into other ways. We give out a lot of school supplies now with our nonprofit, and we're able to collect school supplies in the same manner that we're collecting the food. And we also give out a lot of toys, and we're able to collect toys in the same manner that we, you know, have been collecting the food. And all of these different tactics we've employed can be used for other needs in the community as well. And that's kind of the basis behind Community Solidarity. I hope that wasn't too long-winded.
No, it's fascinating to me because, like I said, you know, I've been involved in doing community service type work, but it's different. And we've had some conversations in the past about it because, you know, I wonder how do you get that message to the partners that come from the need communities that you service? Like, how do you, you know, because I know when we've gone there, you know, one of the things that we always struggle with is, you know, when you bring hot food and there's people that are hungry, you know, trying to get some sort of order with a line. And I know that was a conversation we had. You said, you don't worry about that. You just, you know, you just let it work out, and it does.
Yeah.
Can you share that with, you know, some of my listeners as well as me? Because it's fascinating, and it, you know, it's wonderful. It's an ideal that I would strive to try to teach to the people I work with as well, so that it happens more organically.
Sure. We try to stay very decentralized in every single aspect of what we do. And the ideas we have about not using lines, when we're at a food share, you know, sometimes we get 500 people, sometimes we get even more than that at one given time. And, you know, we'll maybe, to your listeners can imagine this, have 12 folding tables spread out, and there'll be areas that have produce and bread and frozen foods, and it's kind of set up like a little tiny food store. And you can get a crowd sometimes 20, 30 people deep. And sometimes people come to us and say, why don't you have a line? You know, wouldn't it be more efficient to have a line? And a lot of groups do have a line. And, you know, the reason why we don't do that is because we're trying to develop more interconnected communities. And a lot of times in the communities we're working with, there's a lot of social problems. There's a lot of dynamics where one group of people might not like another group of people, where you'll have social problems, where you might have issues of sexism, where, you know, there might be some drunk men doing some inappropriate things. And a lot of times those issues are left to the community to just fester. And when you have a line, you know, it might be easier sometimes as volunteers to just make a line because, you know, people are only interacting with the person in front of them and the person behind them. And it's kind of this strict form of social order we're all used to. We go to the supermarket, we go to online, we go to the DMV, we go on a line, and we're all used to it. So we kind of turn off and, you know, we just do what we're supposed to do. We get what we're supposed to get and we leave. And we want to encourage interaction. And the reality of that interaction is, at our food shares, there can be what is perceived as a lot of conflict. You can have a huge mass of people that perhaps seem like they're not getting along, or there'll be an argument, or there'll be tension, there'll be an issue that comes up. You might even get things that are worse than that. But the reality is we didn't instill that in the community. That's been in the community. And we want that to kind of be, you know, cleaned out by the sunlight. We want that to pop up so the two people that don't like each other are forced to kind of have to be in the same place as each other. The way that we share food kind of involves people asking each other for help. So you might not like that person that lives next door to you, but if you really want the apple pie at our food share, you're probably going to have to rely on them at some point or another and be like, can you please pass me the apple pie? And that involves people having to at least act socially with each other. And so in the short term, whenever we start a new food share location, this can be extremely difficult. You know, we'll have issues, gang-related issues, we'll have social-related issues, racial-related issues, sexism, homophobia. All these things will come out, and there'll be tensions, and it'll seem very chaotic. But at a certain point, enough people start to get it. And so maybe there was a bully in the community that would push people and hustle people and steal from people. And that bully's been in the community for years before we even got there. And people kind of kept their mouth shut because that was a big man and you didn't want to, you know, have a conflict with him. But now everyone's feeling empowered because they're all talking together. And when that bully comes in, they say, no, we don't want you bullying us anymore. It's time for you to start treating your community right. Or if someone's very alienated from their community and kind of has always been closed off, they come and their community starts opening up to them and say, you know what, you're part of our community. We expect you to open up and we want to help you and heal you. And there can be extremely tough days where, you know, you'll have some kind of conflict and you say, you know, why do we do this? But in the long term, you can see people with serious social problems change and mm-hmm. and there's a betterment that occurs. I mean, we talk about it It's not over a period of weeks. It's over a period of years. But some of the biggest bullies that have ever come to us, people who, you know, would in other situations perhaps even get arrested for their behavior, these big bullies that are damaging their community end up being some of the most helpful people to their communities.
I mean, I've seen that, you know, as well. But we are coming in, you know, and making them get online, you know, and then we have issues where, you know, people then they'll get online and then they'll try to cut in again and get seconds before everyone's gotten first.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, teaching the social consciousness of sharing and, you know, making sure everyone gets before you get seconds and those kind of things that some people take for granted, you know, it sometimes has baffled me in these communities that I go into where you would think people would know that, but maybe because they are so used to not having and here's an opportunity for them to get, they just want to get and they're thinking only about themselves and not about will there be enough for the person at the end of the line. How do you deal with that? I mean, I would think people who get up front would take as much as they can and then there might not be enough for people in the back. And or do they take as much as they can and you still have enough?
Well, it's kind of, if someone starts taking too much, we're lucky enough that we've gotten to a point that the whole community can go, you've got enough, leave some for your neighbors. And we'll have different phrases we say. Sometimes we say, you know, if your neighbor took that much, you wouldn't get anything today. And we try to instill that. And we're lucky enough that enough people get it. And they're the voice. We don't really ever have to speak it that often. I mean, if there's a major conflict, if there's someone on drugs or alcohol, we'll intervene then. But most of the time, it's the community itself that can intervene. And it's tough because the idea of scarcity, in terms of, say, if you're a mother with five kids and you show up and you want to make sure your kids have enough food for the week, if you think food's going to run out, you're going to be more likely to push, to grab, to try to get as much as you can for yourself. And we really try to break down that myth. We always have food left over at our food shares. We go very slow. You would think that you'd want to try to help somebody get their food and get them out of there. Well, the whole point about what we do is we want to keep them there for an hour and a half. We want to make sure that they're stuck there, having to deal with everybody, and that things go slow enough that, okay, you might have just got some bananas. And it might be, you know, another 2 minutes before you get a large bag of apples, and it might be another 2 minutes before you get a pizza. But because it's going so slow and because you're realizing that, you know what, there's a lot of food here and it's going kind of slow and everyone's getting a little bit slowly and slowly and slowly, you're not worried about that myth. And
so you bring it out slowly.
We bring it all out at once, but, you know, what we do is, say in areas like produce, we'll have a, you know, we give someone a bag and we say, what would you like today? We'll try to give them some apples, some grapes, some bananas. We try to make it fair. If, you know, there's a lot of, if there's not that many grapes and there's not that many cherries, then you're choosing between grapes or cherries. And we give a person a bag and we say, you know, please step on back. And they have to step on back. Now, the reality is they could come back 5 minutes later, but that's how the system's designed. You know, we want them to feel welcome to come back 5 minutes later because in that 5 minutes, 100 of their neighbors have also got the same thing. And so we're giving them one bag at a time. And the reality is a lot of people leave. The average individual leaving our food share is getting 7-8 bags of groceries. The average family sometimes gets 20 bags of groceries. Mm-hmm. And as long as there's that five-minute gap between every person getting groceries, it means that the single male can get, you know, his one or two bags of groceries, and he's going to be gone. And then, you know, towards the end, the people that want the most will still be there, and that's fine. But the people that wanted just their basic allotment, they already got it, and they're off on their way.
Mm-hmm.
And another part of it, too, though, to expand on it, is the notion of hustling. You know, it can be very bizarre for a lot of different organizations that share free food. They sometimes wonder, why is someone hustling me for this? Or why is someone threatening me to get free food or something? How can an individual do that? And the reason sometimes why that exists in different communities is because you're raised to hustle. Hustling is required to live.
Right.
And a lot of these folks have never gotten anything without doing it. And so there are people, and, you know, I'm not advocating that this is okay, but it's, you know, it's your style of life where if you're seen as not being a tough person that can hustle for things, even if it's free food, then people might want to take advantage of you because they say, oh, that person's weak. You know, they said thank you or something. And that sometimes it's a backwards mentality. But it's a lot of times where you have an extreme poverty, it's how people are raised. You know, people are all in it for themselves because it's the only way they can take care of themselves or the only way they can take care of their families.
Right.
And that's why you have to build community if you want to try to even address the issue of poverty in a lot of these areas.
Wow. So if some of my listeners want to get involved, what would be the best way for them to do that?
The best way they could do it is to just show up at one of our food shares. They can go online and look up Long Island Food Not Bombs. Our website is lifnb.com. If your listeners are interested, again, that's lifnb.com for Long Island Food Not Bombs. And they can just go to our website. In the top tab, there's an area that says food shares, and you can click on that. You can see all our locations. And just feel free to stop by, say, our Hempstead Food Share or our Huntington Food Share or our Bed-Stuy or Farmingville Food Shares and just say, I would like to volunteer. And that is really the best way to get involved, to just first see it hands-on and see how it works. Because from there, if you are, say, a mother who loves arts and crafts, you might realize there's a lot of kids there, and you could set up an arts and crafts table and get the kids to make arts and crafts while the parents are getting food. Or if you are a musician, you might realize, hey, it's great to play some music for everybody, and we have folks that do that. And there's all these different niches where you can fit in, because the reality is it's not a organization, it's a community. And really any of your skills, your talents, your passions, you can find a way of fitting in. Even if you just want to show up and share food, you're more than welcome just to help share bananas or share oranges. And, you know, it's a great way
to
meet
people.
And
so if somebody wanted to make food at home and bring it with them, they could do that?
We ask that they come and talk to us first. We try to make sure that all the food is made vegan, that if there's anything that people could be allergic to, that, you know, they're aware of that, and that there's, you know, notes about, you know, this might have peanuts in it or this might have wheat in it. We try to make sure that everybody is aware of what's in the food. And so if people are interested in cooking, you know, we ask they come for a few times. We have a few conversations with them about it. But then, yes, people do come and cook. And even in our Bed-Stuy Brooklyn location, one of the great things is we come and that location predominantly has fresh CSA food. We have dozens of CSAs we pick up from. And we bring all that food to our Bed-Stuy location. And it's a lot of older women that pick up the food, and they'll actually save a little bit for the following week. And each week, they meet up at a different one of their homes, and they cook food, and then they bring it down to the food share. So everything they got last week, they'll save a little bit from last week, and they'll cook it for this week, and everyone's getting groceries, and people are getting fresh vegan Caribbean foods, and, you know, there's a lot of ways people can participate. If they want to cook, they're more than welcome to, but there's a dialogue that occurs with it.
Right. Well, that's great. So I hear my music coming on. That means our time is up. It's amazing how quick the time goes, John. I could keep talking
with you
for another hour. But, you know, maybe I'll get to have you on again down the road. But I will certainly show up at one of your sites, and I'm looking forward to collaborating with you. And to all my listeners out there, you've been listening to John Stefanian from Food Not Bombs, Long Island Food Not Bombs. And I hope you all can join us sometime.
Have a great afternoon.
Thank you. And everyone have a great rest of the week, and I hope I see you at one of these local events. Have a great day. Bye.